Will Duncan, welcome to the Jake Feinberg Show.
Thanks, Jake. Joy to be here.
All right, I want you to talk to the audience here. When I met you, you were doing a great job teaching. You were traveling. You were, you had a good life. And why did you feel the need to have to take on or to do something like this silent retreat?
Yeah, I'm still trying to figure that out. It's a great question. And of course, everybody asked me that question when I went in. I was actually, before I went into retreat, one of my jobs was I had a talk show. And my co-host said that I can promise you six-digit salary if you don't do this retreat. And she's like, we'll get syndicated. And she's, you know, just trying to, and she's like, would you not do the retreat? And it was, for me, it wasn't even an issue. Why do a retreat? I mean, in a sense, it's the same question as, you know, mountain climbers always get this question of why climb the mountain, you know, and you get 1,000 different answers. I have no idea. For me, it was old seeds. I had, since I was a little boy, I used to pretend I would go into the woods and build this hut. And I remember sitting in there, particularly one rainy day, I must have been about 11 years old or something. And I thought, someday I'm going to do this for real. And the feeling was to do real deep solitude. So I just had some kind of inclination always to do that. As I studied more and more and as I met my teachers, I realized the power of solitude, of separating yourself from the hustle and bustle of the manic world for a bit and to deal with the insanity of one's own mind. A lot of people think of retreat as like a peaceful experience, and it's just not at all. And anybody who's tried to sit for an afternoon even without books or TV or radio or anything knows that it's incredibly difficult to face the mind and to see the neurosis that's going on in the mind.
Up to that point, what was the longest you had been in a silent retreat?
The longest I'd been was 40 days. So I went from
pretty good though
40 days to 3 years.
Can you talk about that 40 days and how? Because I mean, I was talking to Crystal before the show. I said, you know, this cat's coming in, and she's like, I don't even know if I could handle an afternoon, just like what you were talking about. Yeah. And for that 40 days originally, what did you learn about that?
Well, I should say, but before I did the 40-day, I did a 10-day with a friend of mine, classic Goenka style. Those people, some people out there have done Goenka retreats, and you don't talk or anything, but you're doing it in a group setting. And so I was with my friend Matt, and after it ended, the first thing I said to him was, I need therapy. And because you realize, you're like, oh my God, you know, I got some serious issues. And I went into that 10-day retreat feeling on top of the world, you know. I was like in a rock solid relationship. I had a great job. And I'm like, I feel awesome, you know. And I ended it like, oh my God, I need serious therapy. And
can you be a little more specific? How did that dawn on you?
I can't be more specific.
Very well.
All the neurosis of the mind, whatever it is. And the 40 day was just that, but you hit a certain breaking point. And what you're trying to do in a retreat in some ways is you're trying to break yourself. You're trying to hit rock bottom in a sense, so you can then start to clean up what's going on in the mind. The constant distraction, the inability to focus or concentrate, which comes out of an anxiety, a deep, deep-seated anxiety. So in a sense, anybody that's doing a retreat, what you're inviting into your life is touching the source of deep anxiety. It's a terrifying thing. It's an unnerving thing. And in 3-year retreat, you just go back and back and back into that arena, and you go deeper and deeper. But that 40-day retreat was, I wanted to do it very strict and very traditional. I come out of a Gelupa Tibetan Buddhist tradition, and there's a very specific way of doing retreats, and you don't even look outside, or, you know, I was just in this little dark room and in the middle of the woods, and it was profound, difficult, but you get those beautiful moments of, for lack of a better word, I could call it maybe transcendence or something, but where the confinement of the particulars gives way to a beautiful glimpse of the essence underneath the particulars. Mm. It sounds a little abstract, but it's the clearest I could say it right now. But so there's those moments in a 40-day retreat where all the anxiety of going in and the fear of having to face yourself gives way to a beautiful harmony that underlies everything.
How long did it take for you to build your chateau, your home?
I woke up, we went into retreat, December 2010, I believe. I woke up on January 1st, 2010, and I had, a house to build, and I had no money. I had about, $800 in my bank account, and I had about a $60,000 project ahead of me, and I was, with basically no income. So it felt impossible. And then I just started traveling, and people said, hey, I'd love to pitch into this project. And it eventually happened. There was a lot of really beautiful things. So I started building probably in the fall of 2010. And so it was just a few months. December 13th, I got my final certificate of occupancy from the county just 2 weeks before I had to go in. So as soon as I finished building the house, I came into Tucson. I got 13 cavities filled. I had to
at the Rabbit Ranch. Yeah, they have a dentistry thing there.
I had to quit my job. I quit my job in the a Walgreens aisle as I was buying 3 years worth of toothpaste. I called my boss. I said, I'm so sorry. I got to quit. I was hoping to come in a couple more times, and she said, I know. Don't worry about it. But It was a hectic and not a very skillful exiting of the world into retreat. It was a very stressful time for me, but it was a beautiful thing. I'll give you one example of a lot of the beautiful things that happened. We had a really interesting guy coming out doing a lot of our tractor work, and he had a bunch of big earth moving machines, and he had worked for a long time at my site where I was putting up my cabin, and he even let me use some of his machines. I'd never driven a backhoe before, and he's like, it's simple, you'll figure it out, and this was a pretty expensive machine this guy was letting me use. But anyway, the last day he was writing me up the bill for a bunch of the work he had done, and we just got talking about, and he's not interested in religion or anything, we got talking about retreat and why somebody would do a retreat, and he said, let me see that bill again, and he grabbed the bill back and he tore it up. And he said, this one's on me. Good luck in there. And it was just so beautiful. Like,
what did that mean to you?
It just, well, to me, it meant that he, like somebody from, middle America kind of feel, like he was a, highway patrolman. He could understand what we were trying to do, which was gain some sense of, stillness and sanity in a crazy world.
I'm getting at the idea. I think we're going to be able to, by the end of this interview, answer why you did it.
Good.
Because I think that's the idea. You talk about this insane world, the values that are placed on things. He saw what? What did he see? An idea of saying, I long for something other than what we say is important in society. Is that what we're getting at here?
Yeah. I mean, to me, there's a couple different ways of looking at it. But we are... We all know that the world is crazy. We all know that there's a certain level of insanity, the intensity of violence, and all of this stuff is so hard for us to feel, right? Because we're so overwhelmed. I was just teaching recently in class, and I brought up a difficult issue, that people don't want to look at. And I brought it up just as an experiment, and I saw people start to fall asleep, start to yawn, start to look away, because we don't want to hear about things that are difficult. And that's, true for me too. And so what you're trying to do in a retreat is you're trying to just go eyes open right into that, into all of that difficulty. And you're trying to really touch at the heart of it. One thing about retreat is one of the main things I was doing was I was in I was praying. So if somebody doesn't have any belief in, the world outside of prayer or outside of spirituality, then the retreat really doesn't make a lot of sense. It's just like an extended, I don't know what it would be. But so for right. for me, having that basic belief system in the power of prayer, in the power of mindfulness, in the power of one person's sanity actually spreading out and affecting other people, I have that belief system. So the retreat had a lot of meaning for me in that way.
I was going to say, I just wrote down confronting the hard, the hard stuff. I mean, that's really what it is, right? I mean, that's what the plowman said.
Yeah, and I mean, many people out there probably can't relate to a three-year retreat, but you can certainly relate to the need to have a day off a week, or the need to have a couple of days off a week just to kind of recalibrate yourself, get your mind refreshed. So you can go back into the world with a sense of patience, with a sense of compassion. And what I realized in retreat, and one thing that was a little bit surprising to me is outside of somebody's skill at meditating or somebody's intelligence, just by quieting the mind, just that simple act of quieting the mind, a natural compassion starts to bubble forth, like starts to come up. So you realize our natural state is one of caring and compassion for others. That gets piled over with our own anxieties, our own insecurities. And then from that, we get things like violence, we get gossip, all of the, just extrapolate from that. So the implication of that statement I just made is profound, because what's that saying is if you quiet down, if you take a little time and remove yourself, you're actually bringing forth a natural ability to love, to feel compassion. It's nothing you have to do. It's nothing you have to be good at. You know, it's nothing you have to try to accomplish. What you're doing is you're actually doing the opposite of accomplishment. You're simply trying to deal with the anxiety of not accomplishing.
Let's just take somebody who's seeking some kind of spiritual compass,
yeah.
And they are just attached to all their gadgetry,
yeah.
all the digitization, technology, getting stirred up over things that are irrelevant. Could you just give them a list of things that they could do to start unwinding?
Yeah, here's one great practice which a lot of my friends do now, and I've been talking about it for years, and I call them X days. And you look at one day a month, and you put an X in the calendar, and on that day you don't schedule anything. So we're all busy, and you'll find that I just had an X day, and a good friend of mine from childhood showed up on that day. And, I had to tell him, like, listen, I'm sorry.
It's an X day,
But the world will try to, it'll come up with things like, we got a great job opportunity for you, whatever it is. But right. You put an X and, you just say, unfortunately, I can't do anything that day. And then you simply unplug. Unplug the phone. You don't talk to anybody. Maybe go out and take a walk. Or if you're married, it's a little harder with kids. But you might, remove yourself in whatever way you can. Don't talk, and mostly unplug. Everything. No phones, no computers or anything. And I tell people, I like to do my X days with a lot of meditation, with a lot of yoga, and then with some kind of soulful activity. So if people are new to X days, I say, whatever it is you like to do, do some watercolor painting, play around on some musical instruments, do something more soulful and not about ambition, but about just kind of nurturing. And then take some time. Eat meals really slowly. An amazing thing happens when you eat meals slowly. If you want to look at how neurotic your mind is, eat with chopsticks with the opposite hand that you're used to. And you'll realize that there's a lot of anxiety around
eating.
Very
difficult for me, yeah.
And something that happens in retreat that I was really surprised by is the moment you're about to get the food to your mouth, the mind is already flown off and is looking for the next bite, which means that you never actually taste the food. And we can say, well, that's not true. I can taste it. There's garlic. But you're never actually present for a bite. And you can do that. Watch the next time you eat a meal. You lift up the food into your mouth right at about an inch and a half from your mouth. Your mind will then switch to the plate to look for the next food. And if it's the last bite, your mind will look to when's the next time you're going to eat. And it's amazing. It's just, and I had no idea this existed. And as I've talked about it, people are like, yeah, I found that out too. And it's just a common human thing we all share.
You have been leading up to this because you have learned how to be patient, to read certain scriptural texts because of people that were coming into your house from an early age. You didn't just jump right into this, but I was hoping we could talk about your guru and then maybe a couple people that had a profound effect on your evolution.
Yeah, probably the most profound effect in some ways was my first teacher, a man named Murray Rogers. He went to India as a missionary to convert the heathens. And then he got converted himself in a sense. He he met some extraordinary Hindu practitioners, some very deep, deep yogis, and he got his mind totally blown. And he went through a very, very intense dark night of the soul, St. John says, of really not knowing how he fit into the world. And he left the church. He left missionary work, and he began to speak out against missionary work. And then he ended up starting a Hindu Christian ashram in North India. And now this is not it was not an interfaith thing. It was what they call now interspiritual. Interfaith tends to be more like, you know, I'm Hindu and you're Christian and we can talk about how neat each other's religions are. Interspiritual is a little different in that I'm Christian and you're Hindu and you have an understanding of yogic techniques that I don't, that would benefit me.
I love that, yeah.
So he was really, in the 1940s, he was really one of the pioneers of this field. So he started a Hindu Christian ashram called Jyoti Niketan in North India. And it was an extraordinary place. And he spent his entire life in self-imposed poverty, only because he believed that so many people were suffering in the world that he didn't want to live extravagantly while other people didn't even have, you know, their basic needs met. So he lived in extreme simplicity and spent all of his time in deep practice. Extraordinary man. And I met him just by some beautiful coincidence circumstances when I was 13.
Do you still communicate with him?
No, well, he passed away.
No, I know he did. Yeah. But I mean, I asked John Densmore about Jim Morrison, you know, because I mean, there's still, you know, do you still feel him?
I feel him. I don't communicate with him. I don't think.
You're not a weird guy. I know you're not.
Yeah, no. I'm not a weird guy. Yeah. Somebody said, "Will, you're the weirdest normal looking guy I know."
Exactly.
No, I don't communicate with him, and I think he's in a new body or but his I feel his influence. And actually, somebody just recently wrote a biography of him, and she sent it to me, and I'm reading the manuscript, and I'm amazed by all of these things about him I didn't know that clearly were passed on to me. Just a lot of the work he was doing is stuff that I'm actually carrying on, and I didn't realize that he was actually involved in it in the way he was, which is one thing I'm working on now with a few people, is trying to create a new type of monastic system in America.
The thing that the merging of mutual interests within religion, is that something that you like?
Yeah.
Can you talk about that?
Well, for me, it's almost cliche, but I've found extraordinary validity in Christian practices, in Buddhist practices, and in Hindu practices specifically. Not to say that others aren't valid in some ways, but those are the ones that I've been influenced by the most. And not only that, but those three traditions, particularly the yogic practices, the Tibetan Buddhist practices, and the Christian practices, fit together in this extraordinarily beautiful way. And as I've traveled and taught, I've been speaking about this, and I find more and more people that are interested in this. And even in monasteries, in Christian monasteries, I was just recently in an Orthodox monastery, and it turned out that a bunch of the monks had been doing yoga since the 40s. In their cells, and had been studying Buddhist practices. This is all under the radar, you know. And so I think the time has come just for us to be unapologetically willing to delve into the depth of the different traditions, not on a surface level, not in terms of like bumper stickers or refrigerator magnets, but in terms of like the deep practices, and figure out, okay, what is actually valid, what practices actually work. And so what we're trying to do now is create a new kind of monastic system that would incorporate some of the depth of these different practices. And also, one thing you see in the old Russian Orthodox Church is there's in the Skeet communities, was there was men, women, and couples that all lived in monasticism together. So we'd like to bring that tradition back into a new kind of American monasticism.
You spent some time talking about, I don't know everything, but the idea that the confluence of Tantra or the sexuality or sex and meditation. You've been doing some classes on this stuff. Can you? I mean, this is very important stuff for the society that we're living through this time.
Yeah.
It's a very changing time. I think your finger's on the pulse of it, whether you know what you're talking about. But I'd love you to talk right now about what you're doing.
Well, some of my classes do revolve around sex, and to be honest, it's just a marketing scam. I figure there's so much.
Bringing a lot of dough, man.
There's so much already around that topic. I might as well use it for something wholesome. So what I do is, you know, I put in sex in a title, but what I'm interested in discussing particularly is the intense increase of internet pornography. And I try to bring that into a more interesting conversation, because normally when we think about internet pornography, and especially from a religious context, we're talking about it as good or bad, like that, oh, shame, that's a bad thing, you know, or that's, you know, good thing. And to me, there's a much more interesting conversation which rarely gets discussed, which is, does it work? And by work, I mean what we do when we explore internet pornography is we're trying to find some kind of sense of transcendence. We want something that rises above the mundane. And sex is one of the easiest and most beautiful things that does that. I mean, in that moment of climax, there's an exquisite sense of expansiveness, of vastness. If you really pay attention to it, at that moment, the heart is totally open, totally flooded with compassion. So there's a very beautiful reason why we're drawn to internet pornography or any kind of pornography or any kind of deviant sexual behavior. But then we forget to ask the more important and interesting question is, does it work? Does it? So we can say, okay, that's what's bringing us into a relationship with pornography. Does it then give the goods? Does it leave you with a feeling of transcendence? And when what we look at is, no, it doesn't. Mm-hmm. And the studies are incredible now. What it tends to do is it leads to ADHD. It leads to an inability to experience pleasure in the long run. Amazing right there. I mean, we go to pornography because we want to experience pleasure, and we have study after study after study showing us, oh, actually what it's going to do is decrease your ability to experience pleasure. So it's like, oh, wow. It, you know, it's a much more interesting question of, does it work? And if it doesn't, why doesn't it work? And what are some other alternatives? Saint Teresa of Avila talks about it beautifully. She says that, she uses the example of Christ. You know, she says Christ has laid out this banquet for us, and there's just a feast waiting for us. And so it's not like it's not this idea of you should or you shouldn't or you should be a better person. It's this idea that there's an immense beauty that's awaiting for you. So there's an invitation that's being held out for you. And so the discussion is more about how do we miss the invitation? Why? How can we get to the banquet feast? That's the language that Saint Teresa talks about, and I love to think about it in that way, because what we're talking about is one's own pleasure. For example, if we come back to this idea of internet pornography, okay, it doesn't work. So what does work? Let's talk. And just to say this is bad is not going to help, because we're dealing with addictions, and we can go into the whole chemistry of that and the dopamine surges, and you're not just going to get off of internet porn or pot or heroin or whatever it is just because it's bad, you know, or because you feel you've got to replace it with another more beautiful transcendence. The example I often use is when I was a kid, I loved ninja supplies. You know, like, I mean, I had my throwing stars, my nunchucks.
Chuck Norris.
Yeah, my two-toed ninja shoes.
Huge.
Because you have to be silent when you're walking around suburbia, you know? But, you know, that was like, I got the ninja catalog in the mail, and that was, you know, as exciting as it got. I was, like, over-the-top excited. Mm-hmm. So over time, the next thing that happened for me is I started kissing girls, and that was like suddenly ninja was not very exciting, you know, because there was something more beautiful that had taken its place.
Pleasure.
There was a more beautiful kind of connective, embracing connection that made ninja supplies totally uninteresting. What we're stuck in an adolescent culture in this country because we've lost a higher transcendence that can move us out of the mundane of things like pornography, drugs, you know, arguing, whatever we're stuck in, like an emotional immaturity. We have lost the contact, the entryway into a higher, more beautiful transcendence, that would automatically give us distaste for the lower pleasures. So when you can taste that more and more, you're not resisting pornography, right? And that's the key word. You're not resisting drugs. You're not resisting whatever it is. You're lost interest. Because if you have to use willpower, you're going to fail. What you're trying to do is, and what you see over and over in the different spiritual traditions is you're replacing a lower pleasure with a higher pleasure. And that higher pleasure is the deep transcendent connection with the divine, whatever your language is for that. So when you go into a deep retreat, you're almost forcing the issue because you're taking away all of the mundane stuff. You go through the total hell of your own mind. And then you start to begin to get glimmers and glimpses of something much more substantial. And that's why when I say retreat is an incredibly sane experience, what I mean by that is that you're finally touching something of substance. And you mentioned in your intro, Disneyland without keys to the exit. You know, that's what it feels like for me coming out into the world, is I feel like I'm in Disneyland and there's no exit, because it's just facade after facade after facade. When in retreat, I was touching such beautiful depth, not because of my own skill or my own power, but just because to be quiet for 3 years, to not speak, to be in harmony with the natural world, automatically brings you into this exquisite connectivity. For example, I built a sundial, a big Stonehenge-esque sundial, not quite that big, but you know, right. Like little 2 foot, 4 foot rocks. But it was beautiful. I'd never been in one place for 3 years. You know, I've lived in one place, but I've gone on vacation and stuff. And so I was able to then track the moon and the sun patterns over those 3 years. And by the last year, the sundial is completely accurate. The different stones mark all the solstices and equinoxes. You can tell the time of day, the month of the year. But it was so powerful for me just to be connected to actually the movement of the planets, the movement of the sun, the movement of the moon. Nowadays, I don't even know what the moon is doing. But in retreat, there would never be a day I didn't know at what point the phase of the moon was in. And it sounds like a little trivial thing, but it's this beautiful, gives you this beautiful sense of being a part of something that's exquisite.
As we move into the new year, I love having you as sort of the bookend to this year, because you're going to go back for a month now to
I leave in 2 days, and I'm going back for a 1 month retreat. And they say this is an important thing to do. I'm really looking forward to it after a long retreat.
Why are you looking forward to it?
Is to get back in, because I feel like it's the little exit out of Disneyland for a month, you know. And just to touch on some substance and sanity again, I've been traveling for 8 months nonstop, teaching nonstop all over the country and throughout Asia.
Well, I'm going to write you a letter, but you'll be back in a month. Will Duncan, I love you, man. Thank you so much,
thank
man.
Thank you, Jake.
All
pleasure.
Right. And thank you to everyone listening out there. We'll see you in the new year. Peace.